From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Comedians, like their predecessors, the court jesters, are traditionally truth-tellers in our societies. They couch harsh truths within humor to soften the blow at those in power. But we've been told for years that men are the funny ones and that women just aren't funny. That's, of course, changing thanks to the pioneering work of feminist comedians of color like Margaret Cho or Wanda Sykes, who aren't just funny, they're engaging in subversive social commentary, analyzing the changing landscape of comedy and what it means for social justice issues today is a new book titled Uproarious, whose lead author is Cynthia Ouellette. She's the Samuel Candler Dobbs Professor of Philosophy at Emory University. Her earlier books include Interspecies Ethics, Irony in the Age of Empire, Comic Perspectives on Freedom and Democracy. She now joins me to discuss her new book, co-written with Julie Ouellette, called Uproarious, How Feminists and Other Subversive Comics Speak Truth. Welcome to the program, Cynthia.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
So, of course, it's not new that women comedians have shattered the glass ceiling of comedy, if you will. There have been female comics for probably as long as there have been male comics. But what's different about today, especially in the United States today, where we do have access to social media and other channels, you know, ways in which female comedians, feminist comedians have been able to bypass the traditional gatekeeping?
Yeah, that's a very important point. And let me back up just a little bit to emphasize, in part because of the new social media, comedy itself, humor very generally has become an important political force in our culture. It drives a lot of our culture. It's almost the emotional engine for so much of our politics. So you might think of humor and ridicule today functioning something like music, soulful music, did during the 60s and the 70s as a real catalyst for social movements. So comedy has that important role. Now, when comedy really rose up to become a central force, it was largely in the hands of right-wing radio talk show hosts like Rush Limbaugh, who would make fun of the feminazis. But something's changed, and you're right, it turns on the access through social media that feminists and others who have been marginalized now have access to a more public stage.
And of course, there are so many different kinds of comedy, and there's debate over what's considered okay within comedy and what's not. But by and large, it seems as though the kind of comedy that punches up versus punching down is where you can actually tell whether this is something that's in the service of social justice or this is preserving the status quo or in fact even amplifying power. The most famous comedian who perhaps coined that whole term of punching upwards is George Carlin. I'm quite partial to him because of his history with Pacifica Radio. Did a comic like Carlin, although he was a white man, change the landscape of American comedy?
He was very important in bringing forth comedy as a political force. Now, I will say that I'm not sure that he fully understood intersectionality. I'm not sure that a lot of the comics of that time period, Lenny Bruce and others, although important political forces, would understand. They'd understand some forms of power, but perhaps not all forms of power. So it really took everyone from even Roseanne Barr in the 80s, who modeled herself in part off of those comics, to the really rise of strong feminist comedians, Wanda Sykes, Tig Notaro, many others today, to really fully address the kinds of sources of power that women, they've been quite visible sources of power and not always visible to others.
Right. We've had men of color, of course, Richard Pryor and Dick Gregory, who may have challenged racial injustice. It's not clear how much they necessarily challenged sexism, right, or patriarchy.
That's exactly right. So it wasn't clear that they understood all the different ways in which power worked, although they were very important in leading the way for understanding how humor could take on directly sources of power, and especially white supremacy in the United States, as well as its authoritarianism in the 60s with the war, the anti-war movement, pushing it back against that authoritarianism. So those comics were very important. They themselves had connections. They were often mentored by leaders of the Black Panthers. So there was a direct connection between Black activism and the Black comics in this country. And so the change is that now we see that humor has become much more central to feminist movements as well.
Let's actually step back and examine comedy in a more general term. You're a philosophy professor. How do you view the role of comedy in a society, whether it's a democracy or not? In some cases, comedy is even more important when you're not living in a democracy. But how do you view the role that comedy and comedians play? Is it so reductive as comparing them to the court jester of, you know, a different era?
It's very appropriate to do that. Absolutely. You know, as a philosopher, I can't help but go back and think of Socrates, that first philosopher of Greece, ancient Greece, who was in many ways a stand-up. And what did he do with his humor, his irony, which is what he's known for? He directed it against the powers that be. And for that, he was eventually sentenced to death. But he was a truth teller. And that's the real impulse behind both a lot of humor and philosophy. And that use of humor in particular to reveal truth has been especially potent. And if you think about it, it's because humor, unlike probably any other force, goes right to that existential core of who we are. For example, in one way, ridicule can strip us right bare and expose our vulnerability to even degradation, humiliation. It takes power from us. So humor can take power from us, expose us, expose the truth and expose lies, and it also can empower us.
Right. So when we talk about the way in which comedy has functioned, it can take power away from those who are both powerful, but also power away from those who are powerless. It's not naturally a force that is equalizing. I mean, I'm thinking of white performers performing in blackface for white audiences as comedy, reinforcing racism, punching down at disempowered peoples, right?
That's right. And so a lot of American humor began as minstrel humor, began supporting the white supremacy of the U.S. And so that was absolutely a punching down. And it was a punching down that was thought to be just in, well, good humor, that to be just entertaining, without the full force of it always being understood, without the full politics behind this seemingly innocent entertainment being understood. So it's very important for us to understand the politics behind what seems to be as innocent as an easy joke.
So let's talk about some of the comics today who you analyze in your book, the contemporary comics, and how they take their approach to comedy. What makes them subversive as opposed to protecting the status quo? I mean, you mentioned Tig Notaro and Wanda Sykes. You've also examined in your book women like Margaret Cho, and also male comics like Hari Kondabolu, who's an Indian American comic. Can you give me a sense of why their comedy fits within that same kind of truth-telling that societies need?
What they do is that they have really something of a double-edged sword. So on the one hand, they use humor very well for ridicule, to expose hypocrisies in our culture, to expose hidden forms of racism. But on the other hand, they do something more than that. If they just did that, that would be in itself worthwhile. I mean, that's something that is essentially akin to, it's akin to preaching to the choir. You embolden those or strengthen those who are subject to racist forces, to misogynist forces, by ridiculing the stereotypes that have been degrading, that have been exclusionary in our society. But I say there's a double-edged sword there, because it's interesting too how they often will use aspects of what we call having a sense of humor, of poking fun at themselves as well. And what this does is it makes them relatable. Mm-hmm. It makes it easy to laugh with them at the same time that we laugh at various stereotypes, various social norms that we may not have questioned before. So what they've done with their humor is that they've opened us up to more fluid identities, so that we can find ourselves perhaps laughing, perhaps when we listen to comics who are mocking Islamophobia, for example, we might, as whites, find ourselves sitting side by side with persons of color laughing together. And that's important. That's a very important social force.
So when you say that they have a a double-edged sort of approach to comedy, do you mean that say a woman like Margaret Cho can make fun of other Koreans because she's a Korean American comic and other women, but when she does it, she has the right to, because she identifies with that social demographic, that ethnic and gender demographic. And that may be something that opens her up to people, and her humor up to people who might not otherwise, you know, want to take her seriously.
Yes, but it's very important to make several distinctions, two big ones here. And one of them is that even as she exhibits a sense of humor about herself, mocking herself, that she is not playing on the old stereotypes in a way to reinforce them, that she's not engaging in what Hannah Gadsby calls that humor of self-humiliation. It's one thing to use humor to open yourself up, to show your vulnerable points. It's another to walk right into that trap of self-humiliating humor that puts you back into the misogynistic culture, for example.
Right. I mean, I don't mind watching women make fun of things that women do, but I have a big problem with men engaging in sexist stereotypes. And the same with, you know, if an Indian comic makes fun of other Indians in a way that I can relate to, that to me could be funny, but definitely not a non-Indian doing the same.
Exactly, exactly. And that's the very second important point, that we know that just as a white person does not use the N-word, you do not, you make jokes of those within your own community, and you do them the right kind of way. So that, for example, if women, as Margaret Cho did, says that she doesn't want to be called gay or heterosexual, she just wants to be called a slut. Well, she's calling herself a slut. And when she does that, she's reappropriating that term and giving a positive spin on it. So it becomes no longer a term used by those to degrade women, but instead a term where that what was associated with shame now becomes understood differently, associated with even a kind of pride and a kind of joy. But it's very important exactly who is using the words that are epithets often used as insults. Who is using them, and what kind of context? And if we don't understand that context, we don't understand the force of the joke.
What are the challenges that comics like Margaret Cho or Wanda Sykes have faced in just, you know, getting to the place where they have gotten to? I imagine that they've had to claw their way to the places that they are now, because, you know, we've been told over and over again, women aren't funny, and women of color, we know, have a much higher bar to meet in order to even get the meetings with, you know, Hollywood executives to get your own comedy special, for example.
Yes, that's right. So Margaret Cho, for example, talks about how she was invited originally in Hollywood to play the standard stereotypical roles of Asian women. I mean, roles like being a prostitute, how hard it was to work out of that. And then when you're on the comic stage has been traditionally male terrain. So when women are there at all, they're there as an object of the joke, not the subject, someone who is actually the agent making the joke. And to make that shift is very difficult to do. And it does require not just a very skilled kind of humor, but it also requires having a right kind of audience, including an audience that is ready to support you. This is a kind of audience that critics, like Tig Notaro has talked about this, how comics, that is, need audiences there, that so that when they open themselves up and to connect with the audience, they feel that vibe coming back.
We have been told, especially those people who are progressive, who are feminist, who have used humor as a tool to expose power, are often dismissed as liberal snowflakes by conservatives. And yet, of course, when comics do address power, it's often conservatives who shy away from it, who get very angry about and who have a huge pushback against comics of color and feminist comics in their analysis. And sometimes, you know, sometimes maybe people do push the line too far. I remember Kathy Griffin's perhaps mistaken approach to holding a bloodied Trump head in her hand. And of course, the right wing media went crazy about that. Anytime anyone has ever mentioned, you know, one of Trump's children, people on the left are dismissed as being unfair. So how to tiptoe around the feelings of the powerful?
That is difficult. I mean, you know, we have to go back a bit and think about how, you know, speaking of the powerful, remember the history, for example, of lynching in our country. And lynching could happen if a Black man just said one word that was a little off to a white. So words have carried tremendous weight. And usually when insults are perceived as threats to, say, white power or to male power, then those threats are perceived as real harms. Whereas when humor is turned the other way towards those that are not in positions of power, to the socially marginalized, it's often perceived to be just a joke. Why can't you take the joke? Why are you so sensitive? So remember that power is something that is very visible to those who are victims of it. And it's not visible, as visible to those who are abusing power. But it's very easy for comedians to expose all of this too. And in fact, Hannah Gadsby and her Nanette, her special Nanette, she does a great job of doing exactly that, when at one point she starts mocking the men in the audience and she asks them how they like that being turned into a subcategory. And then she plays on that a bit and says things like, "Ah, it's just a joke, can't you take a joke?" But the idea is to show the men in this case in her audience that humor is a powerful force, and its force of insult can be as harmful as, well, as they say, sticks and stones.
Right. And then conversely, of course, the right wing has dismissed the notion of political correctness as being a barrier to their right to have free humor at the expense of the rest of us, to freely express their humor at the expense of the rest of us. How do you view that angle? This was something that Donald Trump, you know, partly campaigned on when he was running for president, the left and its political correctness. We need to do away with that, et cetera.
Well, in this country, we don't have laws such as hate laws that limit free speech in that kind of way. But we all understand, we all know that speech is not to be used to harm others. And there are laws against libel and slander, for example. So the question is, when does speech harm others? And in the case of humor as a type of speech, when does insult fuel hatred And when does it, on the contrary, work against hatred towards a more inclusive society? And there we're really on contested political terrain, because it's very easy for us to, on the one hand, agree with a lot of comics who said that it's important to punch up rather than down. If you talk to a Trump supporter, those who are laughing with him when he turned the debate stage with, for example, Hillary Clinton into a comic stage, they will argue that, well, Hillary Clinton represents the elite and that she needed to be taken down a notch. So it's all about power moves. And the question is, how should power be distributed? What kind of ultimate goals in society should we have?
There's the issue of the content of feminist comics, etc. But then there's also representation, right? How critically important is it for young people to see folks that look like themselves up on the stage with the confidence that it requires to do comedy and gain exposure to wide audiences?
Very important, and for one especially interesting reason, and that is the way in which having a sense of humor has been a marker of inclusion in our society since at least the Depression, the 1930s. Sometime around then, there was a cultural shift, and humor was valued. It was an important trait of our personalities. So the question of who is allowed to laugh, who is allowed to make a joke, who is allowed to be seen as funny, is akin to the question of who is allowed to be included among us in the community. For example, FDR, it was important for FDR to use humor, as it has for our president since him, to use humor in various ways to show that they're one of us.
Finally, we also have not just with the spread of streaming services like Netflix that have given more platforms for women comedians of color, we also have TV shows like The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel that have showcased the fact that, you know, in the 50s, there were attempts by women comics to be taken seriously, and this show being quite contemporary and quite popular now. Do you think it's also changed the landscape of how women comics might be thought of?
Yeah, it's important for women comics who are now recognized as a strong force to realize that they do have this history. It's a history that hasn't been talked much about. It's been assumed that, for example, women, originally that women didn't have a sense of humor, only men did. And then that was changed to like, maybe women do, but feminists don't. But to realize that, no, women were practicing that art of comedy. And as you say, in the 50s, and often in either radical ways or in highly skilled ways. So to see that hidden history is to understand that women have been always part of producing that dimension of culture.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Cynthia. Good luck with the book.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed the interview.
My guest has been Cynthia Willett. She is the Samuel Candler Dobbs Professor of Philosophy at Emory University. And we've been discussing the book that she co-wrote with Julie Willett called Uproarious, How Feminists and Other Subversive Comics Speak Truth. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.